Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's now time for me to open this evening's open floor hearing. My name is Edwin Maund, and I am a member of the panel of examining inspectors who've been appointed to examine, report, and make a recommendation to the Secretary of State for Transport on the application made by Highways England for a development consent order for the A303 Amesbury to Berwick Down road scheme. I will now ask the other members of the panel to introduce themselves.
I'm Wendy Mackay, I'm lead member of the panel.
Good evening, I'm Alan Nowitzki.
Good evening, my name is Ken Taylor.
Apologies. We're assisted at this hearing by the Planning Inspectorate case team today. We have Richard Price and Eva Sherman and Paige Hall. They will be pleased to help with any procedural or other queries that you may have this evening. I will now explain some of the housekeeping arrangements. Acoustics, just want to check that the sound system is operating effectively and that everyone can hear me, including those at the back of the room, if you might be able to indicate. Thank you. If there are any difficulties in that respect during the hearing, then please do draw that to my attention or let a member of the case team know. Mobile phones, may I please ask you to switch those off during the meeting so that participants are not interrupted by them when they are speaking. Fire alarm, there is no planned fire alarm testing scheduled this evening, so if the alarm does go off, the duty manager will first check the alarm control panel, advise us whether it is a false alarm or whether evacuation of the building is necessary. If an evacuation is necessary, then please leave the building by the nearest marked exits, and please do not re-enter until advised that it's safe to do so by staff. The assembly point is next to shop mobility. Is there anyone present who would need assistance in the case of an emergency? No, thank you. So, in terms of sound recording, an audio recording is being made of today's proceedings, and this will be available on the National Infrastructure Planning website as soon as possible after the event. I need to make it clear to all of you that because the digital recordings made are retained and published, they form a public record that can contain your personal information and to which the General Data Protection Regulation applies. The Planning Inspectorate's practice is to retain and publish the recordings for a period of 5 years after the Secretary of State for Transport's decision on the development consent order. It therefore is important that you understand that if you participate in the hearing, you will be recorded and that your consent to the retention and publication of the digital recording is effectively given. To avoid the need to edit the digital recordings, the panel would ask that speakers try to avoid adding information to the public record that you wish to be kept private and confidential. If it's genuinely considered that there is no alternative to the disclosure of such information, the panel will agree a process to allow that information to be provided and made available without it forming part of the public record. In terms of social media, if anyone present intends to use social media, report, film, or record these proceedings, then please do so responsibly and so that it does not disrupt the meeting. If it does disrupt the proceedings, then I will have to ask for it to stop, and that also applies to filming anyone who does not wish to be filmed. Is anyone intending to film?
If I may, sir. My name is Reuben Taylor from Highways England. This is just to say that we do have a camera relay set up to another room for members of the project team to be able to hear and see what's going on. It's not recording in the sense of us being able to replay it later, but it is running and it's focused on the panel, so it doesn't actually show the audience in any way at all. It's simply to provide the team with information as to what's going on in order to assist me and therefore hopefully to assist you either today or in the future.
Thank you. For anyone else filming this meeting, it's important that you make yourself aware of the responsibilities for satisfying yourself you are operating lawfully within the data protection regime. The only official record of the proceedings will be the audio recording that I've already mentioned. Other communications arising out of this hearing will not be accepted as evidence in the examination of this application. Now, can I ask participants today to come forwards to the table at the front when called to speak? And when you begin, please give your name and the organisation that you represent. When you do come to speak, can you please speak clearly into the microphone, making your contribution so it can be recorded accurately. Now, just before I go on, there's a couple of cameras operating over to my left. I was wondering if you could just advise the panel what you're doing and the purpose of it, please.
We're making a documentary program surrounding Arthur Pendragon. It's an in-house program and it won't be broadcast, and we'll only be focusing on Arthur himself, who'll be speaking at today's panel.
Thank you. When you say it's in-house, in-house is what organisation?
The British Record Industry Trust, BRIT.
Thank you. In terms of the press, if you're here today from the press, please make yourself known to the case team. We will be proceeding, therefore, as explained in Annex E to the Rule 8 letter dated the 11th of April 2019, which gave notification of this open floor hearing and provide a link to the indicative agenda. The purpose of the open floor hearing is to provide an opportunity for interested parties to make their oral submissions to the panel. It also gives the panel an opportunity to ask the speakers questions about the evidence that they've presented. Oral submissions should be based on representations previously made in writing by those participants. However, we have already read those written submissions, and they will be afforded the same weight as those made orally. Therefore, what we're looking for is not for those written submissions to be repeated, but instead, this is an opportunity to provide further detail and explanation to help us understand and fully appreciate the case you're seeking to make. The procedure that we will follow today is to hear first from interested parties who've notified us in advance of the meeting that they wish to speak, and they will be invited to come forwards in order to give evidence. As indicated in the agenda, to make best use of the available hearing time, we will allow each interested party a maximum of 5 minutes for their oral submission. We do have the discretion to allow people to continue beyond that maximum time period if we consider there would be of a benefit to the examination, but we would advise you not to rely upon that discretion. And being exercised and to stick to the time limit as best you can. The panel may then wish to ask the speakers questions, and the applicant will be given an opportunity to briefly respond to any matters raised by each speaker or in summary at the close of each session. I would ask for those present not to interrupt whilst another person is giving evidence, even though you may agree or disagree strongly with what is being said. It's important that everyone has a fair opportunity to put their case without interruption or other distraction. Government guidance for the examination of applications for development consent explains that the examining authority may refuse to hear evidence which is, in its view, irrelevant, vexatious, or frivolous, relates to the merits of a national policy statement, or repeats other representations already made, or relates to compensation for compulsory acquisition of land or an interest in or over land. Additionally, the examination authority may request any person behaving in a disruptive manner to leave the hearing or to remain only if that person complies with specified conditions. So I have a list of those who've indicated that they will be speaking this evening, and they will be called in the following order. King Arthur Pendragon, Jono Rollo Morfling, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Barry Garwood, Robin Parsons, and Andrew Nicholson. If there's anyone else in attendance who wishes to make submissions that have not already been made, then we do have discretion to hear any relevant submissions from those present, should time permit. So I just clarify, Mr. Taylor, you've obviously already spoken. You're speaking for the applicant this evening.
Reuben Taylor for Highways England. Yes, sir, that's correct.
And I also just check that, is it your intention as this morning to just do a summary at the end?
It is, sir, if that's satisfactory.
So if I could invite the first speaker, Mr. Pendragon, to come forward to give your representation. Thank you.
Is that working?
Thank you.
Sirs, ma'am, I hope you're aware that I have submitted three documents in what I refer to as an electronic bundle that perhaps will explain any questions you may have that's already in your library, but I may need to refer to them if you ask me some questions at the end, but this is basically what I wish to say this evening. My name is Arthur Pendragon. I am one of the better known of perhaps though more than a handful of senior druids who represent the wider pagan and druid community and those who gather at Stonehenge. There is much we agree with in the evidence and opinions put forward by the Trials Riders Fellowship and the Stonehenge Alliance. We stand with them. We have, however, very specific issues of our own. These issues relate to the proposed scheme and how it could and would negatively impact on the practicing of our faith in and around the environs of Stonehenge. Our first concern is about the possibility of light pollution from the western portal and how it might affect the view from Stonehenge of the setting sun at the winter solstice, one of the alignments which Stonehenge was built around and significant in our faith for us to witness on an annual basis. We are also very concerned about the close proximity of the western portal and works to the burial mounds and how this would adversely affect the sacredness and integrity of the World Heritage Site. To the east, we have many of the same concerns as the Blickmead group and feel the portal and works are far too close to known and as yet undiscovered archaeology, and any possible resting place of ancient human remains whom we refer to as our collective ancestors. As well as these concerns, we have major reservations about our future ability to gather at Stonehenge for solstice and equinox in the way we have since the late 80s and four times a year since the full seasonal gatherings were reinstated from the summer of 2000. The various authorities concerned leave it unclear as to how this scheme may affect the current rights of way and any possible changes to the positioning of the byways open to all traffic that we use for the purpose of gathering in order to practice our seasonal observances, leaving us to conclude that our seasonal gatherings have not been given the consideration that they merit within the scope of Articles 9, 10, 11 and 14 of the Human Rights Act. Finally, we are seeking reassurances that any ancient human remains unearthed along the route or in works should, after a reasonable period of study, be reinterred as close as possible to what should have been their final resting place. It is important within our belief structure that we are able to relate and in doing so commune with the ancestral spirits in situ that we believe inhabit this most sacred landscape. It is this very sacredness that is in part responsible for the recognition that the Stonehenge World Heritage Site is of outstanding universal value. All too often when dealing with Stonehenge, we tend to put the cart before the horse. The only reason that we are having this detailed look at this scheme, or that this scheme was proposed in the first place, is because Stonehenge is part of a World Heritage Site that bears its name. We should first look to see why Stonehenge is of importance and what makes it special to the nation and the wider world beyond. There are two very simple reasons for Stonehenge's unique place in the nation's psyche: its age and its sacredness. Now, you can argue as to when it was built or how people have worshipped, but the facts remain. It's ancient. Older, for instance, than the Catholic Cathedral of Notre Dame. In fact, older than Catholicism itself. And just as valued by its faith community as any cathedrals are to theirs. And to many, it is sacred. We can argue as to the use as an observational point for which it was built and the importance of keeping the sight lines clear and free of light pollution. And we can argue the importance of ancestral worship, placed at the dead, as Professor Mike Parker Pearson would have it. We can argue this and much more, but what you cannot be argued is that it is a place of pilgrimage four times a year for a community that holds it as sacred. In summary, we find it disrespectful to suggest that such a unique place of reverence and worship as Stonehenge, where folk are able to commune with the greater ancestral spirits and view the sun rising and setting as did their forefathers before them, could be stripped of the dead and bereft of the integrity of the solitary burial mounds rising up through the mist, while still connected by the genus loci within the greater sacred landscape, all for the sake of fiscal gain, it being cheaper to build a shortboard tunnel than a longer one. You do not need singular tunnel or double vision to view this scheme, but triple sight would not go amiss. And by triple sight, we believe this tunnel, short-sighted, wrongly sighted, as we have sighted. So mote it be.
Thank you. Any questions from...
Could I just pick up on a last point that you made, which referred to a shorter tunnel? Does that mean that you would have no objection, had the scheme been designed with the longer tunnel?
When I first came to the inquiries about the tunnel, long before this panel was set up, when it was first suggested by Sir Jocelyn Stevens, we were, and I was representing at the time, I was the Battle Chieftain of the Council of British Druid Orders and representing all the Druid Orders in Britain at the time, and we were in favour of the tunnel. We were in favour of the longboard tunnel and always have been, as until recent times with the National Trust when they decided, along with English Heritage, to go for a shorter board, and I think the sole reason for that is financial. So we're not against tunnel par se, we're against this particular one because we find and feel it too short. Mom.
Thank you. Also, you've referred to the various articles of the Human Rights Act. I think I picked up Article 9, 10, 11, 14. Did you just mention Article 8 as well?
I didn't, ma'am.
No, just 9, 10, 11, and 14.
9, 10, 11, and 14. And to back that up, one of the documents you'll find in your library that I've already submitted is my reference, Document 2, which is actually a transcript of Pendragon v. United Kingdom, 1998.
Yeah, it was just in relation to this particular scheme. Perhaps you could be a little bit more specific. I know you did explain in it very succinctly, which we appreciate today, how you believe that your human rights would be breached. But could you give me just a little information, more specifically related to the articles that you mentioned, if you could expand on your case in that respect?
Yes, certainly, Mum. The articles in question allow for freedom of worship, they allow for freedom of expression, they allow for us to meet together and exercise our religion. Meeting together, the ability to meet together is exercised, and we exercise that by parking on Byway 12 at this moment in time in order to go to Stonehenge and celebrate the dawn of the longest and the shortest.
Sorry, just wait 1 minute, because someone's phone's going off, and I think we don't want to be interrupted or distracted by that. So If that could be silenced, thank you. Right.
It's the exercising, as I read from my prepared statement, it's the exercising of that right which is dependent upon the byways at the moment, but also the rights of way. And none of the authorities, certainly highways, have not made it clear what they wish to do with the byways open to all traffic and the rights of way. And for that reason, we do not want to be put in a position, which is what is happening now, where we are forced to use English Heritage's facilities and charged for it in order to gather at Stonehenge, which we see as a means of stealth, as a pay and pray policy. They will tell us that no, we're not being charged to pray, we're being charged to park. But if this scheme goes ahead in its present form, there is no guarantees that we will have anywhere to park other than in their car park and be charged for it.
Thank you.
Just taking up the point about the form of the tunnel, you confirm that you support a longer tunnel. Now, moving the western portal outside of the World Heritage Site would be one aspect of that. Would you also want the eastern portal moved eastwards as well, or are you content with it in its present position?
In an ideal situation, sir, yes. We would rather the tunnel entered and exited beyond the World Heritage Site. We're not going to board tunnel simply because, as everybody knows and any geologist can tell you, if it's going through the chalk, there's no archaeology. The archaeology is all above it, and if it's a bored tunnel, that's fine. The original plan, or one of the original plans put forward by Balfour Beatty when the tunnel was first mooted, was for a cut and cover tunnel, to which I said no, you know, and we opposed, and we said there would definitely be the biggest protest in Europe if they wanted to go ahead with that, because that was totally unacceptable. So then, from our mind, they changed to the idea of a bored tunnel. They then come up with two alternatives, a longer bored tunnel, which we were in favour of, and as I alluded earlier, so were National Trust and a number of other agencies, and a shorter bored tunnel. The longer bored tunnel was the one that got the approval at the time. They then said there was no money available and it got cancelled and was never built. They then came back with the scheme that's before you at the moment, which is for a shorter bored tunnel. And we believe the only reason they've done that is for fiscal reasons. It's got nothing to do with the World Heritage Site or its protection. It's simply to do with the fact that it's cheaper to do a shorter bored tunnel than a longer one. And for that reason, we oppose it.
Yeah. So my reading of your position is that as long as the tunnel is through chalk and therefore doesn't disturb archaeological remains, you're content with that situation?
We're content with it and where it is, to the south of Stonehenge. If it were to go beneath Stonehenge, as some people have said and the press is quite often reporting, then we would be opposing it anyway. But we're content to a tunnel going through the chalk to the south. In fact, it is further to the south, which means that any traffic is actually moved further away from Stonehenge than the A303 is now. Why would we not be in favour of that? We've always been in favour of that option, were it a longer tunnel.
Yeah, okay, so you're content with its alignment in relation to the A303?
Yes, we are content with the alignment, and we are content with the bored tunnel as opposed to a cut and cover one, but we are not content with the length of this one.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Pendragon, you've mentioned that you would be in favour of a longer bored tunnel, but you've also set out concerns you have with the potential impact the scheme would have on Byway 12 and your ability to access it and gather there. Would a similar concern not arise with a longer bored tunnel to your concerns?
It probably would, but I'm pretty sure that if they were going to spend the money on a long bored tunnel, they'd look to spend the money on sorting out the accesses to public right-of-ways and byways open to all traffic. The mere fact that we weren't consulted by highways over the rerouting or proposed rerouting of Byway 12 until it was already in the plans, I find strange. And I find it strange because even the United Nations respect us and agree that we are, in effect, stakeholders at Stonehenge. And I find it very strange that Highways have not consulted with us at all. Had they have consulted with us, I'm sure it could have been sorted out as to where public right-of-ways would be for us to access at times of worship.
Thank you.
Hopefully just one final question. Following the preliminary meeting, the examining authority sent out some written questions, and one of those was directed towards yourself and other people who'd expressed religious beliefs associated with Stonehenge and its environs. We've not had a direct written reply to those questions, so it may be that you've not seen it.
I haven't, sir, and I apologise now, but if that could be resent, I would certainly.
I think what you'll find is that it's on the website rather than being sent to you directly individually, but I think it would be of benefit if you have a look at it and provide us with a reply, perhaps in line with the summary of your submission today at deadline 3, and that hopefully will aid us in understanding about your spiritual beliefs in relation to the area.
That's next Friday, is it not, sir? Deadline 3. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we've got no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
If our next speaker can come forward, please. If you just introduce yourself when you're ready.
My name is Rollo Morfling, and I'm Archdruid of Stonehenge and Britain, and have been so for over 30 years now. You've just heard from my colleague, Arthur Pendragon, and during that time we've both been very much involved in making arrangements with Wiltshire Constabulary and Wiltshire County Council and English Heritage and National Trust, with making arrangements for celebrants and pilgrims to come to the four seasonal observances at Stonehenge, that is the summer and winter solstices and the spring and autumn equinoxes. Now, I tend to make this submission quite brief. I've come down tonight especially from Gower in South Wales, just as really as a token of how much Stonehenge and its environments, its landscape mean to myself as a Druid, not particularly me to more than any other Druid, but as this is something which is crucial to belief in Druidry in this country, this is why I've particularly come tonight. Because it seems that in this inquiry and in the possibility of discussions of what routes are going to be taken around Stonehenge, and this has been going on, as you know, for some time. I was at the first inquiry at the Red Lion in 1995, and since then developments have taken the course you probably well know. The thing is that there is this harmony that needs to be established, a blending, if you like, between the needs of the motorist and the needs of landscape and the preservation of the landscape. It's absolutely stupid to have an absolutely pristine, perfect landscape and that motorists is having hell getting up and down every day. And I've been just as many times as in local people, well, perhaps as many times as local people, but I'm perfectly familiar, as are local people, with when Stonehenge A303 becomes bottleneck and congestion. Equally, it's no good to have a wonderful free pass for motorists to speed up and down from London and at the expense of ripping up the landscape. So what I want to really put to the panel this evening is, and to the audience as well, if you imagined yourself, and just to say for a moment, if you imagined yourself were Highways England and you had, for instance, a commission to build a tunnel underneath the Houses of Parliament, shall we say, one which would go from Millbank in the south to Victoria Embankment in the north, shall we say. Well, obviously, this is a tunnel project, a big built-up metropolitan city area, which goes from point A right the way underneath through to point B. And so the idea of anything like that ending up, coming up in the middle, shall we say, in the middle of the Palace of Westminster and Palace Yard, and but stone's throw from the Speaker's chair, would be absolutely ridiculous. No one would put up with it for a moment. But in the countryside, these kind of obvious parameters tend to get overlooked. It all appears to be fields, and so it all, you know, not everybody is familiar with the ancient archaeology going back to Neolithic times and how important a World Heritage Site this is. And so we've got a situation now which seems to be that instead of building a tunnel from the eastern portal over by Vespasian Camp right way through to the western portal at Long Barrow Crossroads, for some reason this proposed short tunnel is coming up almost in the middle of it again, right by Stonehenge. It's stone's throw from Stonehenge. So if you're actually in Stonehenge, whether you're actually participating as a worshipper or whether you're a tourist paying £89 or £18 or whatever it is to get in to Stonehenge with English Heritage, you're going to be overwhelmed by the amount of noise that there's going to be off that western portal, because it's a two-lane highway. I saw some drawings that appear to be three-lane highway. I mean, you're getting twice or three times much congestion of traffic, much, much louder, much, much louder. Never mind at night time of the lighting and everything that has to be for these portals, and the rest of it, especially on a winter's evening. Again, Arthur Pendragon was talking about the winter solstice sunset. Very important sacrification, but occurs at about 4:30 in the afternoon. This is why we have concerns about sound and light. It seems rather than taking away the 21st century congestion and clatter from the landscape, we are actually intensifying it with this particular proposal. So this is why we as Druids are saying the only solution to this really is the long bore tunnel, and hopefully generations to come, they won't be asking, oh, why did they go to all that trouble to build a tunnel and not take it the last couple of hundred yards to make it purely completely underneath the Stonehenge bowl? We would like that future generations would think that we did a jolly good job. And so that's why we propose the long bore tunnel. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to pick up your comment about the noise and lights, and whether you're aware of, because of the depth of the cutting right through to the new junction, and including the new junction west of the A360, it is a cutting which is not lit in itself, the car lights would be low enough not to emerge into the landscape. I wondered if you're aware of that.
I wasn't specifically aware that it was deliberately designed to that effect. This is obviously a lot better if that is the case. But if you spend any time at Stonehenge, you know that in wind conditions that you get there, you sometimes hear traffic coming down the road from down the hill from Amesbury. You sometimes hear the traffic that's going backwards and forwards in front of you. You sometimes hear it coming over from the other side, from roughly where the pig farm is and where you're talking about the cutting is, I believe, at the moment. So I would imagine it's not absolute certainty that this is going to be totally obviated, is it?
Well, I'm not here to support Highways England's proposal. I was just pointing to an aspect of it that I wondered whether you were aware of, and I'm not here to answer questions either. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've got the same question I asked of Mr. Pendragon in terms of familiarity with the question that we'd posed at the end of the preliminary meeting, and wondered if you would be able to respond likewise about your views of the importance of the site, sort of spiritually and religiously for you, by deadline 3 next Friday, just to help us.
Yes, certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Barry Garwood, please.
Good evening. everybody, and thank you for listening. I raised the issue of outstanding universal value at the preliminary meeting, and wondered if we could look at what we actually mean by that. Much mention is made of improving the outstanding universal value, or OUV, of the site. But OUV is a United Nations expression, and the advice of the United Nations is being openly ignored with this proposal, particularly with the positioning of the tunnel portals within the World Heritage Site. Another point, the statement of outstanding universal value mentions only the Neolithic and Early Bronze Age, but this was ratified in Phnom Penh in Cambodia in June 2013, before the Mesolithic discoveries of Blackmead were widely known. And beyond that, there's a number of post holes, which I pointed out at the site visit yesterday, that are Mesolithic in origin, that were discovered during the construction of the old car park adjacent to the Stonehenge Stone Circle, I think about end of the 60s, early 70s time, which three of these, there are post holes rather than apparently a tree stump, as far as I can gather, suggest there was a circular structure by the arc they formed that stood there perhaps around about 10,000 years ago, so probably twice as long ago as Stonehenge. It seems likely that whoever built Stonehenge was building on an earlier history. Now, given the recent findings at Blackmead, I would suggest that a future look at the statement of outstanding universal value of Stonehenge should expand it to include the earlier Mesolithic period as contributing to the outstanding universal value, and that we should consider very carefully what damage may come to the archaeology of Blackmead, especially by any disturbance to the hydrology of the chalk aquifer, particularly in the vicinity, for example, the foundations for a flyover Countess roundabout, or the tunnelling through the chalk aquifer. That's almost certainly going to change the hydrology or the hydrogeology, the way the water flows through the rock, by creating a great big dam, as Dr. Reeve of the Stonehenge Alliance put it, changing the flow one way, but also possibly fracturing the rock and drawing water away from the tunnel portal areas towards the lower point at Stonehenge Bottom, where it's perhaps going to flow up and come to the surface there with this concrete dam just below the surface. So I really think that we should consider carefully what the outstanding universal value of the site is. Now, of the pachyderm on the plain, people would say the elephant in the room, but it's not a room, and back in those days it would have probably been a woolly mammoth. So the pachyderm on the plain is the management of the solstice events. I mean, it seems to be a big bone of contention between various respondents, those who would want to be able to attend solstice and other spiritual events and to visit the stones of their own will rather than be guided by the heritage industry. Stonehenge holds great spiritual value for many, as acknowledged by the statement of outstanding universal value, which also mentions the solstice gatherings. Now, any closure of the byways or the route of the A303 to travellers visiting for special events is likely to create more problems than it solves. I mean, the spiritual aspect of Stonehenge should not be dictated by the heritage industry or by highways, but people should be allowed to believe what they will, and in accordance with their human right to freedom of religious expression and belief. So, and in addition, the proposals for the wholesale closures of public rights of way and creation of others would set a very dangerous precedent for future schemes, I believe. Now, I'm personally not particularly in favour of any tunnel at all. I mean, both Stonehenge Stone Circle and the row of burial mounds that align with the Neolithic Long Barrow, adjacent to the Long Barrow roundabout, show evidence of a later people building on earlier traditions. Now I wonder, after humans bring about their own extinction through climate change, through more and more road building, a future intelligence will come along, look at this great big hole they've dug through the chalk aquifer that forms the lifeblood of the Stonehenge landscape, and think, what on earth is this?
Can I just interrupt? Sorry, you're over your 5 minutes, so if you can come to a close, it would be appreciated.
I have a number of points, but if you don't want to hear them.
Well, it's not that I don't wish to hear them, it's about trying to respect everybody equally.
Could I just add, you can include them in your oral summary?
Can I, so
let's put in the summary of your oral submission, can be included at deadline 3 in writing.
Okay, thank you, madam.
I have a question. The comments you've made about Blickmead and the hydrology and hydrogeology of the site, and you've referred to other representations that have already been made and submitted. Do you have any evidence of your own, or can you elaborate on the concerns, and also in relation to the evidence that's been provided by Highways England on that particular matter?
Well, I'd find, first of all, that the evidence provided by Highways England is all a bit vague and difficult to follow. One key concern is that the examination appears to be trying to examine material that is not in the public domain, which is the geology data that has been discovered recently through boreholes, which I gather a limited amount has been made available to Stonehenge Alliance up to 2017, but even they haven't been allowed the most recent geological data to analyse. So it's very difficult for people to say what is going on. Another with the geology, you know, Highways know more than we do, so it's very difficult for us to examine what the true facts are. Another point with the hydrology is that when we were at the Blickmead yesterday, the representative of Highway seemed to have very little idea where these new hydrology wells, the monitoring wells, had come from and who'd put them there. He was taking photos and was going to find out. So although their documentation keeps coming to the conclusion that no adverse effects have been found based on their own risk assessments and summaries, it really seems to me that they don't have much idea at all of that, and they're just saying it.
Thank you.
I don't know if you could just give us a brief personal insight of the importance of the byways and Stonehenge and the World Heritage Site to you, and the use that you actually make of it.
For me, it's part of our heritage, it's part of our history, it's the cradle of our civilization even. I mean, I think it's fair enough to say that Blickmead, with its warm springs that run at a constant 11 degrees or so year round, would have been a draw to animals, and with all the flint there would have been tools for butchering them available. So this would have been a place of early civilization. As the Mesolithic organic archaeology appears to be saying. Beyond that, I mean, the stone circle itself that we see today, it's said that it's not fully understood, but it's clearly has some kind of astronomical or astronumerical purpose for measuring celestial alignments or movements. I mean, for example, it could be used to measure the precession of the Earth's rotation through the heavens, which is about a 26,000-year cycle, but it's often thought to be understood by the ancients. Like the moment our pole star is Polaris, but if we go back to the end of the last ice age, the pole would have been much closer to the star Vega, which is some distance apart in the heavens now. So, you know, it's. You know, we don't fully understand what the ancients knew about astronomy and science, but they clearly knew a great deal, and this is a really important site. And for me, to be able to come close to it with the byways, to not be have to have my visit managed by a heritage industry that really wants to paint a particular picture, but to have my own access, to be able to go there with my dog, and who doesn't walk very far, so I need to be able to park there, and for others, including disabled people who can't walk there, and people who can't afford the I think £23 it was when I looked yesterday to cost to go in. I mean, really, it should be open to everyone. And I would defend access to any right of way as a right of people to use it. I wouldn't object to the tarmac being taken up off the A303 and the dual carriageway removed from Blickmead if the older coaching road could be left as a byway open to all down through Amesbury. And beyond that, all the wider landscape, the barrow groups, you know, the other features that we've seen, they form a wider landscape that was built up over many thousands of years by ancient people. They have a great spiritual value for many. It's not just the great big stone circle that's so impressive. It's the wider landscape and the history that holds so much value.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You noted that you weren't in favour of any kind of tunnel.
Not particularly.
What I was going to ask you was, what would you like to see happen? Would you like to see a road outside of the World Heritage Site, or would you like to see things continue as they are? What's your ideal solution?
My ideal solution would be, for a minimum, some sort of bypass for Winterbourne Stoke. Clearly, it's extremely disruptive to have the A303 running through the middle of the village, but not necessarily. I mean, one solution would be just to leave the traffic as it is past Stonehenge. I mean, that's quite congested. But so I've suggested in my written representation a number of alternative routes, one of which would be to feed into the packway at Larkhill and then build a new new road from a sort of southern bypass for Bulford from the Durrington Walls roundabout linking to the A303. Another scheme would perhaps involve using the Boscombe Get Down Airfield or the vicinity of that to feed into a route that runs to the south and possibly that would form a northern bypass to Salisbury. I mean, I think there are a great deal of many options that can be looked at in depth, but that have been discounted rather summarily with this one and only scheme that we've been presented with. And it would be very useful if we could examine the alternatives in more detail.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robin Parsons.
I don't have anything quite as spiritual as these gentlemen to speak about. Mine is fairly a little bit more mundane, but considering the way I've been treated over the last 3 years of consultation, and I use that term loosely, I felt the need to come in here and speak. I own land adjacent to the A303 on the very western edge of the project. I fight the 303 every time I need to get to this piece of land, but it's very important to me. I'm a tenant farmer in the next door valley of Wiley, and the piece of land that's adjacent to the A303 is the only asset I have. When the proposed bypass came about 20 years ago, I fought for it to go anywhere but through my land, as you would imagine I would. And that was purely on the basis of sacred cows. Who wants their cow to be slaughtered for everyone else? We had a change of government and everything was cancelled. We've now spent the last 20 years with increased traffic, and where I live, which is along the side, the A36, totally blighted by the fact that Stonehenge and everybody who lives in London and owns second homes in Cornwall wants to get there, which is up to them, it's a free country. So when the proposed bypass comes back again, obviously I decided that I again will fight for a different route. But in my heart of hearts, where I live is blighted by the fact that the 303 is permanently blocked. And a 15-mile radius around Stonehenge is blighted by the fact that traffic will do anything to get around it. So all of the roads and all of the villages are congested. And it's not just weekends, it's 7 days a week now. So although a road is going to go through the middle of my only asset, half of me has already decided that I will have a benefit from it. But for the last 3 years, I have been in discussion with the designers of this road in what they laughably call consultation. And at no point have I ever been offered an alternative to their proposals in design. So everything has been presented to me as a fait accompli for the last 3 years. This is what we're doing. What do you think about it? And it doesn't matter what I say, because the next meeting we have, it's moved on to the next thing. Nothing's changed. Nothing has really been considered. So what I'm being presented with at this late stage is a road that is going to go straight through the middle of my only asset, leaving me less than half. It's going to be compulsory purchased, which I will have to pay capital gains tax on, and I can understand paying capital gains tax if it's a voluntary exercise of selling your property. My only asset that I have been able to do business with and use as security is going to be halved. And on top of that, the people designing this road are going to design a really bad road, which is going to be a blight for the local village, which should actually be celebrating the bypass's existence. The whole scheme over the last 3 years has been studying wildlife, it's been studying bats, it's been studying geology, archaeology, it's been studying heaven knows what, some stuff I have no idea why. And it's cost millions upon millions of pounds. 90% of this was done 20 years ago. There are many bypasses around Salisbury that could have been built on the money that was spent looking at building it. So, over this last 3 years, they've decided, in their wisdom, that the green bridges that have now been proposed for things like bats and other wildlife to go across the 303, Highways England have decided that this is a fantastic opportunity to not build any other bridges, but to bring everything to these green bridges, to allow access, not just for wildlife, but for public rights of way, restricted byways, agricultural access, private access, which to me is balmy, because at what point is a green bridge not a green bridge?
Again, I have to, you're beyond your 5 minutes now, so is there any further final points you'd wish to raise?
Yes. In a conclusion to the green bridge scenario, because they're using these green bridges, they are not only taking half my land, but they are also then using part of what remains to add additional public rights of way across it, They also propose that the A303 that is going to be stopped up remains open to all traffic. Tarmacked. Now, I know what happens with fly tipping and everything else when you have a dead end like that. And it's going to be creating a problem for years to come.
I'm going to have to draw you to a close, I'm afraid. But if, as we said before to previous speaker, if there's additional points you wish to add in writing for deadline three, then please do so that we can understand fully your concerns.
Okay, thank you.
I think we've also read your written what you've already put in writing, and I think some of those points. Yeah, we have. And the points about Green Bridge 1 and your suggestions for the alternatives. So I think there might be some questions on that in a minute, but we have read that just to reassure you.
Yeah, well, good. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Parsons, I've got a number of questions.
Good.
So we have read the relevant representation, the written representation that you've made has been made on your behalf.
Good.
I just wanted to clarify what type of farming activity you carry out on the parcel of land you own, and also the linkages, if any, that has with the land that you tenant, just so I can have a better understanding of your operations.
Absolutely. Well, I tenant farm 200 hectares in total. And the land that the proposed road is going to disrupt is 32 hectares of that. I run them purely arable, but I also run them as a block, so they are run as one unit. And I make use of it as one unit to run environmental schemes as well with HLS and ELS across the whole 200 hectares. So obviously I'm going to have discussions with Natural England about how I can, once the road's gone through, if it does finally go through, how I can provide other areas in my tenanted land to make up for those that are going to be taken away from by the road. Stone Curlew plot, for instance, is going to be decimated. And obviously I am under contract for a 10-year contract to provide environmental parts of the scheme. So I run it in conjunction with the rest of the farm. And bearing in mind the rest of the other parts of the farm are tenanted, then having this asset also allows me to spread my costs over that extra area. So it makes me considerably more efficient. And in actual fact, it probably makes me either, the profitable side of farming rather than the loss side of farming.
Could you just approximately how far distant is your tenanted land from the land you own?
About 4 miles.
In your representations, you've made a number of suggestions, partly in terms of the location of Green Bridge 1, but also a possible location for an additional bridge further to the west.
Yeah.
Could I just have you clarify where your preferred location for the bridge you've mentioned to the west of the off Green Bridge 1? And also, if I've understood your representation correctly, your desire was for Green Bridge 1 to be located in a slightly different location to it being proposed. So if I have a bit of clarity around that, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, regarding the Green Bridge, from the surveys, the BAT surveys that were done, which I think is the predominant reason why green bridges are proposed, because there was quite extensive research done across the plain, I believe. And they tend to follow fence lines, and they tend to follow hedge lines. And where they're proposing to put the green bridge, even in their map, as I think I said in my representation, they've even proposed to plant hedges to try and guide, the wildlife to the bridge. My simple thoughts were, wouldn't it be a better idea to put the green bridge in the right place? Because that in itself would reduce land take.
And just to be clear, where you consider the right place for Green Bridge 1, could you just explain where that is?
Have you got a map in front of you? because it's slightly to the east, you can actually see in there that there is a an existing fence line. So it would be probably only 100 metres to the east along that fence line, which would actually join two copse together, which is, I thought, what the idea of it was.
So related to that and your suggestion of an additional an additional bridge to the west is then the impact that has on what you describe as then not requiring a need for what you're describing as routes 2 and 7. Could you just explain that to me and why you think they would not then be necessary?
Well, if off the top of my head, I think route 7 is the additional road that would go from what is now the 303 across the end of my field to the Green Bridge. So, you know, that would not be necessary. And also, O2 is the other side of the 303, which would be the road that would take the traffic that's gone across the Green Bridge all the way back up towards Yarnbury Castle to the west.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I just want to be clear that I understood the routes you were referring to.
And that in itself will actually reduce the amount of land take on both sides.
Okay, thank you. And then my final question is, you've raised a concern about the A303, this section that runs to the south of your land and a little to the east, remaining open to all traffic. And your suggestion is that essentially it's closed at the B303. I just had a question about then that road, that section of the road does allow access to a number of sites, including access to your field, if I've understood it correctly.
Yeah, it does.
Scotland Lodge.
And
just your comments on the implications of that, because it would still be even if it weren't open to all traffic, it would still remain as an access. And so I just wanted to be clear why you consider that would be a better solution than is currently proposed.
Well, the current proposal basically is just open to everybody. And whilst that in different circumstances would work, is the fact that if they build another bridge, it won't be necessary, because you won't need to have all the access for everybody.
Just my understanding is that you weren't suggesting it wouldn't be open as a public footpath, but it would just not be open to
a public footpath. I have nothing against public footpaths, but what is very difficult is, I don't want to use the term policing, but policing a byway that is restricted and yet still allow agricultural access for large machinery, because the two don't mix.
Okay, thank you. Your clarifications have been helpful.
Good. It's a very difficult thing to police.
You described the proposals as comprising a really bad road for the village, I think those were the words.
Sorry, which was the bad road for the village?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, really.
I took it as meaning this current proposal.
The current proposal is a bad design, because if you end up with, I mean, let's not mince words, you end up with 500 caravans suddenly parked up the old A303 on the tarmac, and it becomes an irregular gypsy site, because I don't care, I'll not mince my words. It then becomes a blighted area just up the village from Winterbourne Stoke, just down the road from Berwick St James.
Right, so it's the possible use that the old A303 will be put to.
Yeah, fly tipping, you know, whatever you want to do, because let's face it, it's a dead end tarmac road that runs for half a mile.
Yeah.
What do you want to do up there? You can do anything you like, it's not restricted.
Yeah.
It's open to all traffic.
Yeah. Okay, I understand.
I mean, it doesn't take an awful lot to sit down and think, what could I get up to? You know, but that's going to be in the local area. And the other thing I think I said in my statement was that because it's far enough away from Stonehenge and in English heritage, they won't really care too much because it's out of sight, out of mind. And when you've got a solstice going on and you have an awful lot of people that are justifiably there for all sorts of different reasons, you also have an awful lot of people that are there for all sorts of different reasons. And they are going to get forced away from what would be a secure area around the stones. And this sort of site that is being created will become a complete nightmare for the locals. And it's all right for people that have designed the road because they've left. But Wiltshire Council is left here with something that happens twice a year and a problem has been designed in that is going to cost the locals every time, not just financially. So it has to be thought through.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Andrew Nicholson.
Thanks. I wasn't going to speak today, so I'm,
I want just, to... Sorry, if you'd just like to introduce yourself when you're ready, and then we'll...
Yes,
we'll...
I want to own to feeling nervous, and I hope that I can read my own writing and so on. I'm Andrew Nicholson. I'm a member and representative of Cycling UK and other organisations. I live in Wiltshire. I've been a cycle campaigner for 40 years. I spent 20 years in the cycle trade. I've represented cycle interests at road schemes over 15 years, and in particular, although I endorse the submissions made by Jill Anderzark on behalf of COGS and Cycling UK, I want to address the interests of faster and more experienced cyclists, road cyclists, both using roads for leisure, sport, and for work-based trips. Cycling is strategic in government policy, not in the sense of journey length, which is how Highways England tends to define trips as strategic, but in emissions and carbon strategies that Highways England is or should be involved in and committed to promoting. Just as technology has advanced in roads with smart motorways, smart tunnels and so on, traffic management software, cycling is also is booming. It's evolving partly due to technology with things like GPS or sat-nav, fitness apps, and very significantly e-bikes, which are booming and bringing about a big increase in the number and length of journeys and the speed of journeys. The scope of a typical cyclist trip is being transformed. It is for Highways England to appreciate these emerging trends and reflect them in its proposals. But Highways England has failed to characterise cycling and the range of kinds of subgroups of cyclists, people using bicycles for their trips, and these emergent trends. Highways England's stated programme for the entire A303, A358 corridor is to make an expressway, it would be the A303M, where cycling, among other categories, will be prohibited from end to end. This scheme isn't the whole programme, but it is the first part and sets a precedent. There is no other A road in Wiltshire or any of the surrounding counties, except for one in Oxfordshire, where cycling is prohibited. And you yourselves have seen that there are challenging conditions for riding bicycles on many A roads in this southwest region or sub-region. I'm going to be, of course, making the case that cycling should under no circumstances be prohibited in the proposed scheme, including the tunnel. Cyclists do use the main A303 at Stonehenge and elsewhere. The Road Time Trials Council has very long-standing time trial courses in at least Hampshire and Somerset. I haven't done full research, including dual carriageways. The very popular app called Strava, S-T-R-A-V-A, has an online global heat map showing active and significant use of this section of the A303 by bicycle. People put Strava segments online. Some of these run along the A303, some across the A303 on the A roads. Anyone can go and see and count pedal cyclists using this A road. Highways England has not characterised people using bicycles adequately. There are many subgroups, as there are with people using motor vehicles. So fast commuters, fitness riders, long-distance cycle tourists, many of them international, club riders, time trialists. Prohibition of cycling in the tunnels is not justified, as far as I've been able to discover from their evidence so far, by real health and safety concerns. Put in any level of detail, even though it fits in with their future aspirations. In other European countries, I can name Norway, there are main road tunnels which are smart from the point of view of cycling, so that a cyclist pushes a button, the tunnel tells the motorist that the cyclist is there with flashing signs. And Highways England is committed to smart roads and using technology. It's also committed as a first priority to the safety of its users. I want you to find that cyclists are existing and legitimate vehicular users of this scheme. If the tunnels as designed will be unsafe for cycling, Highways England may hold that view, it would be because of their proposed design, which of course is the responsibility of the promoter of the scheme, Highways England. So they then need to modify the design, not resort to prohibiting a class of vehicle. Technologies are available, as I said, and the proposed tunnel bore may or may not be enough to accommodate cyclists safely. Turning briefly...
You are beyond your 5 minutes, so again, if I can ask you to quickly summarise, thank you.
I was going to add that the tunnel will be attractive to cyclists, especially after dark and in winter. I can make written submissions about the surface route, which is essential. It's a sealed surface, and the stakeholders need to be informed that it must comply with national guidance for a cycle route. But finally, I think that... as proposed, the scheme effectively imposes a curfew, a nighttime curfew, upon cyclists, so that there's complete severance for safe cycling between the A303 west of the scheme and the A303 east of the scheme. And my comrades in cycling find that to be utterly unacceptable.
Thank you.
Mr. Nicholson, you mentioned making tunnels smart in terms of cyclists.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't have any idea how that could be done. You know, can you give me an idea of how that could be done?
Okay. You asked about making it smart, not making it safe, did you?
Well, I would think that it would need to be safe, wouldn't it?
Smarter would be safer, yes. I was the original promoter of the... two tunnels, Greenway at Bath, and one of the ways to make a tunnel smart is lighting 24 hours a day, or responsive to the presence of traffic, so you can save energy there. I'll go into detail about the Norwegian example of a smart tunnel. These are road tunnels, main road tunnels. Cyclists, a single or group of cyclists approaching the tunnel will be presented with a pole with a button they push, saying push the button if you're going to cycle through the tunnel. There tends to be a cabinet with some high-vis vests, one at the other end to put it back. the system responds to the demand made through the button push by setting off signals visible to motorized users of the road, informing them that there is a cyclist or cyclists in the tunnel. And there would be the option, I'm not a signals engineer, of varying speed limits temporarily, of highlighting the position of the cyclist by some kind of lighting scheme or some such, and enhancing what would already be an acceptably safe and relatively pleasant riding experience by drawing motorists' attention to the importance of cycling safety and to the fact that at that point in time, while they use the tunnel, cyclists are present.
Right. You mentioned a Norwegian example. Did you know the name of that?
There are several tunnels on a road I've forgotten the number of. Would it help if I gave further evidence and details in written submission?
If you put it in your post-hearing submission.
Written, yes.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Yes. Okay.
If you don't remember now, that doesn't matter.
There are a number of tunnels. There's a whole website devoted, and I'll give you the reference to the relative safety of various different road tunnels in Norway.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Just following on from that, you have mentioned the Norwegian example, and you've also alluded to the two tunnels, Linear Park at Bath.
Yes.
My understanding is that the scheme at Bath is not open to all traffic, so it's primarily
true.
Used by pedestrians, runners, cyclists.
Yes.
So are you aware of any examples in the UK similar to the Norwegian example you've discussed?
Road tunnels with smart measures to protect the safety of cyclists? No. I am aware of other road tunnels on A roads in the UK where cyclists are better off using the tunnel than alternative routes, and that does include underpasses in London. But I'm not aware of that kind of scheme. More's the pity.
Thank you. It might be helpful in your written summary if some of the examples where you consider that cyclists are safely using some tunnels, or if you could set out some of those examples in the UK as well.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. And I want to say that Norway isn't necessarily the only place with such measures in Europe or the advanced world, but it's the one that I was able to quote an example in detail. I think there are other examples in Switzerland, Austria, other EU countries. Thank you.
Now, if there's anyone else in attendance who wishes to make submissions that have not already been made, then we do have discretion. Is anyone wishing to speak? Okay, then I'll come to the applicant then, please.
Thank you very much, Reuben Taylor for Highways England. As with the session this morning, I am not going to respond to every point that's been raised in the session this evening. Where I don't respond to a point, no discourtesy is meant. It's simply that for large part, some very detailed points have been raised, and I'm simply not in a position to be able to respond in any way that's likely to assist you in your deliberations. Insofar as a response will be required, one will be provided deadline three as appropriate. What I'm going to do is respond on a sort of issue by issue basis. I'll try not to repeat the points I made earlier today also. In terms of the impact on the Stonehenge community, you will be aware that there was a detailed assessment of impacts in the equalities impact assessment that you've been provided, which identified no significant impacts upon the Stonehenge community.
further detail has also been provided in a response to written questions, HW1.17, deadline 2, which you also have, which makes the same point. In particular, the concerns raised this evening appear to relate to the potential impact on the scheme on the ability to use the rights of way network. And I think we heard in particular concerns raised about the ability to use, I think the phrase that was used was byway 12. In fact, the coding for that particular byway is AMES 12, A-M-E-S 12. I'm instructed that AMES 12 is not affected in any way by the scheme. There is no diversion of it, it is not rerouted, it is not reclassified. What the scheme does do is remove the existing line of the A303 for use by vehicular traffic and turns it into a green route. That does affect a byway in the vicinity of Stonehenge, byway AMES 11, which was not referred to this evening. That byway at present is a byway open to all traffic, as is AMES 12. AMES 11 at present you can access heading, I've got to get my east and west the right way around, heading westbound on the A303, you can turn left into it, and heading north out of AMES 11, you can turn left onto the A303 heading west. Those two movements will no longer be possible as a result of the scheme. But there doesn't appear to be any suggestion here that the change to access to AMES 11 in that way would have any material effect on the ability to gather and worship for solstice events. Indeed, AMES 11 is still accessible via alternative routes in any event. But in terms of the impact on AMES 12, there is no change as a result of the scheme. Turning then to the question of alternatives, a number of people raised issues relating to the potential for a longer tunnel and also in relation to a southern route. You will have already seen in the environmental statement, chapter 3, reference to the consideration for the potential for a longer tunnel. The length of the tunnel has plainly been carefully considered. The preferred route announcement in September 2017 was based on a 2.9 kilometre long twin bored tunnel, and since then, during scheme development, in response to consultation, the applicant has amended the scheme to extend the tunnel further. Two changes were made to the location of the western portal, which resulted in a 300 metre extension to the tunnel. Further extension of the tunnel, either to the WHS boundary or a further 600 metres beyond the boundary, to a point in the landscape where the natural topography provides a suitable location for a portal was also considered, and those extensions were ruled out because they wouldn't deliver sufficient additional benefits to justify the additional cost, and they would have had operational impacts upon Long Barrow Junction with consequent adverse effects on the local highway network. They were not ruled out simply on grounds of cost. A full analysis was undertaken. And indeed, in the most recent responses that you've had, that is explained in some detail in the response to written question AL 1.29. In relation to the southern route, the potential for a route to the south has also been carefully considered during option testing over a number of years, and it was rejected because it wouldn't deliver the scheme objectives as well as the proposed scheme for a number of reasons. I could spend time explaining to you now what those are, but I'm sure you're well aware of them. And in any event, there is a very detailed explanation of the process that was undertaken in the optioneering process and the reasons for the rejection of a southern route in the response to written questions AL 1.10, 1.11, 1.12, 1.13 and 1.14 that were provided at deadline 2. In relation to traffic noise affecting one's ability to appreciate the stones at Stonehenge, I'm instructed that the removal of traffic from the existing alignment of the A303, some 165 metres from the stones at their closest point, to a new route significantly further away, and part of which is in tunnel, will inevitably reduce the noise impact of traffic at the stones. Turning then to points made about OUV, the point was made that we needed to understand what the OUV of the World Heritage Site is. Well, that is very carefully appraised in the environmental statement and the appendices to it that you have. It's been the subject of much discussion with many consultees over a long period of time. The one thing that can be said is that the OUV of the World Heritage Site is very clearly understood by Highways England and has been and forms the basis of its appraisal of impact. I think those are all the points that I need to trouble you with. Thank you very much indeed.
So if there are no other matters that anyone wishes to raise, I shall now close the meeting. Thank you very much for your attendance this evening.